then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's August the 30th, 1914. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Greetings to Mr. and Mrs. America and to all the ships at sea, as the Jew Walter Winchell used to say on his radio program. I'd also like to send a special shout-out as well to all the guys and gals dressed for success in the cubicles at the FBI Criminal Justice Information Systems in Clarksburg, West Virginia. According to our tracker, they are now regular listeners to Radio Free Northwest, as well as our local droids over there in Seattle and the Spokane offices. Yes, as you can tell, I've been looking at NorthwestFront.org's stat counter. Oh, we also get periodic visits from U.S. Naval Intelligence, several people somewhere in the Pentagon. One funny visitor keeps popping up in Northern Virginia who might be a CIA front. And then there's the Washington State Police, all kinds of funny IPs that appear to be state and local government, as well as federal. Plus, of course, every now and then our old buddy Cass Sunstein at the White House drops in. Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, right? Would somebody please explain to me just what the hell that means and why there needs to be somebody like that at the White House at all? Kind of reminds me of that old British comedy series, Yes, Minister, where the Jim Hacker character is Minister for Administrative Affairs. Anyway, for those of you who don't remember him from media reports back in early 2010, Cass is the Jew who runs the Cognitive Dissonance or Cognitive Infiltration operation out of the White House. The purpose of the program is to counteract what Sunstein calls, quote-unquote, baseless and malicious conspiracy theory regarding government on the Internet. So, in order to counteract this idea that the government is involved in shady doings, Mr. Sunstein and his boys and girls monitor Internet bulletin boards that discuss certain sensitive subjects the regime doesn't want discussed. Sunstein and his paid cognitive dissonance operatives infiltrate dissident internet boards and forums, as well as flooding the comment sections of blogs under false identities. He and his operatives attempt to disrupt and derail discussion, create confusion and doubt and demoralization, spread false rumors and personal vilification, so forth and so on. Sunstein and his department were presumably behind the large federal order placed over a year ago for what's called persona management software, which allows one individual to run up to 16 separate identities on Facebook under false names and IP addresses in order to manipulate public opinion on social networking sites. Although I suspect the Obama re-election campaign was involved there as well. Now, this is how Sunstein and Obama counteract the idea that the government is engaged in conspiracy? I swear to God, you couldn't make this stuff up. Now, some people have asked me why I do things like baiting the FBI and Sunstein and other people who have the power to do me harm on this program. Am I nuts? Do I have a death wish? Am I conspiring to get thrown in jail so I can get free health care like that triple bypass the feds gave Pastor Butler so he would survive to his sedition trial in 1988? No, I simply have a realistic view of what's going on in the world. I realize that I am completely powerless to affect anything that these reptiles do. If it fits into one of their little plots and schemes to destroy me, then they're going to destroy me, and there's not a damn thing I can do about it. This, I think, was the reason that they did what they did to Edgar Steele, just to prove to themselves and to others that they can effectively intern whoever they want. Of course, now they have the legal right to do that anyway, but in 2010, when Steele was first arrested, the National Defense Authorization Act hadn't been passed yet. Nowadays, they can simply drag people away to an undisclosed location without charge and keep them for as long as they want, any time they want. All they have to do is get some federal judge or U.S. attorney to use the T-word. They can literally come and take me away anytime they feel like it, so why shouldn't I at least have a little fun before my voice is silenced forever? This, by the way, is one reason that all you guys need to be downloading all these Radio Free Northwest podcasts and saving them on your own hard drives for a rainy day. The source is not infinite and may be cut off at any time. Guys, let me run this down for you again. Right now, in this country, so-called anti-terrorism is a multi-billion dollar industry, almost completely taxpayer-funded. That's billions of dollars in the hands of government to parcel out and play with, a massive cake they can cut up every fiscal year to suit their desires of the moment. Now, what you have to understand is that in modern-day America, indeed in America more or less since 1933, this is what government and government service is really about. Who controls the money and how much of it and how many other men and women's service and allegiance can you buy with that money? In the world of today, money is power, and that goes for within government as well as externally. I believe it was Alexis de Tocqueville who once wrote, "Democracy always fails when men discover that they can vote themselves money from the public funds." Now, that's what's happened in the United States. It happened a long time ago. And the public funds have gotten bigger and bigger, and right now one of the biggest budgets in the entire federal system is the budget for so-called anti-terrorism. And without terrorists, there can't be anti-terrorists. Burn that into your brain, because it explains so much of what's been going on in this country for the past 20 years and even before that. Remember your history 80 years ago, when J. Edgar Hoover used the media and the movies to build up a small gaggle of two-bit punks and stick-up men like John Dillinger and Babyface Nelson and Bonnie and Clyde into this big national crime wave that could only be stopped by bringing in new federal laws, giving the government more power, and giving the FBI huge new budgets? Well, they're still doing it. Without terrorists, there can't be anti-terrorists. And all that lovely money disappears out of various federal agencies' pockets. They can't allow that to happen because their control of that money is the source of their power and their ego and their self-image. Now, you know those old sayings about how clothes make the man and you are what you eat? In the federal government of the United States, money makes the man and you are what you spend. The FBI by now understands perfectly well that neither I nor anyone associated with me is committing any crimes. They have been watching me since 1973, since before many of you were even born, and they haven't caught me so much as spitting on the sidewalk or square dancing in a roundhouse. So the Bureau knows that there is no legitimate reason for this past 40 years of voyeurism on their part. And yet they still keep it up. Because there is that huge budget that has to be burned up before the end of the next fiscal year. Because if any agency or federal department ever comes in under budget, then rather than being rewarded for being thrifty with the taxpayers' money, they're punished for it by having their money cut for the next quarter. I have this lingering, horrible suspicion that, in fact, the Edgar Steele case might not be as deep as I thought. Steele and Kevin Harpham, the bionic backpack guy, may simply be budget burners to try and keep the Spokane FBI office from losing money and manpower to other places around the country. Now, Pastor Butler and the Hayden Lake Aryan Nations compound were God's gift to a whole generation of FBI and ATF men. At one stage in the 1980s, there were more ATF personnel in the Spokane office than there were in New York City. And that meant that those guys got to have homes and lives and raise their families in one of the last really nice places in the country, and that's quite a draw, quite an incentive not to want to move. Now, given the fact that the movie and TV and FBI hype is bullshit, and we're not really terrorists, more's the pity, without Pastor Butler, there's no need for all those federal law enforcement personnel up there in those offices. I mean, how much real crime does a predominantly white area like eastern Washington and North Idaho have? feds are starting to get reassigned to places which are a lot more fertile for fabricating media terrorism of the kind that keeps those FBI budget dollars rolling in, which is what the Bureau seems to be concentrating on these days, convincing poor old Apu down at the Quickie Mart to hold some household chemicals for a so-called friend, or giving some fucked-up Americanized brown Muslim kid who doesn't know which end is up a fake suicide bomb belt, that kind of stuff. This means that these agents are getting reassigned to largely Muslim urban areas. Detroit with all its Iraqis and Palestinians. Minneapolis with all the Somalis and Hmong. Atlanta with all those Iranians is likely to become a big new bureau destination in a couple of months. Maybe even Chicago, God help the poor bastards. New York and New Jersey. Now, okay, some of the younger single agents might like the club scene in New York or Chicago, but the other agents, the buzz-cut booyahs and the Pat Boone types, do they really want to raise a family where the cost of a house in a physically safe neighborhood runs into millions of dollars? And does any parent, federal agent scum or not, really want to have to send their kids to the Atlanta or Los Angeles public school system? FBI agents, of all people, don't let their kids go to school with niggers. Not even the black ones. So, that's still more expense that a transfer out of Spokane or Seattle or Portland incurs. The cost of a decent private school for the kids. Look, I keep on talking to you guys on here, but you don't seem to take the hint. We can solve each other's problems. Find some legal way to lay about $300,000 on me. No armored car robberies, please. And I promise I'll buy some land outside Spokane somewhere and put a couple of trailers on it and make it our official Northwest Front compound. I'll run up the tricolor flag, we'll be on TV all the time, maybe we'll even work up some costumes and wave a few AR-180 semi-autos in the air. And you guys can all come back to Washington State and spend the next 20 years or however long until I kick the bucket watching us and following us around and taking down license numbers and sending in more spies wired for sound and filing just all kinds of good old reports with your rabbis in the J. Edgar building in D.C., so forth and so on. Now, how's that for a plan? Kidding aside, look, these people are going to do whatever the fuck they're going to do. There's nothing I can do to stop it, so I might as well have some fun with it before I really do disappear. Okay, moving on to some emails. This is from somebody named Chris, and I don't know where he's from. Dear HAC, what are the words you say at the end of the show before you say freedom? Thanks, CJ. The words are Irish Gaelic, Sarsha an da Bann, which means white freedom, or literally translated, freedom to the white. There is a kind of ongoing dispute between myself and a couple of Gaelgwars we have on the list who insist that the Irish word for freedom is pronounced Saoirse. And yes, I know, that's the way the Irish actress Saoirse Ronan pronounces her name. I learned my Irish, such little as it is, from the Conrad na Gaeilge in Harcourt Street in Dublin, and also from listening to RTE back in the 1980s, that's the Irish National Broadcasting Authority, who had legally mandatory airtime in Gaelic, including news broadcasts that nobody ever listened to, because when I was there, only about 40,000 people out on the West Coast still spoke Irish as their native language. And while the language was taught in the public schools, it was just one of those courses that you had to pass as a child, like algebra or social studies, and you immediately forgot about it when the school bell rang. Anyway, there are several different regional dialects of Irish, and not all of them pronounce every word the same. I know for a fact that at least one dialect pronounces the word for freedom as Sarsha because of an RTE documentary on Padraig Pearse I saw, and also because of one old guy whose name I can't recall who was a newsreader on RTE television. Remember, this was in a time and place when white men with gray hair and their own teeth were still allowed to show their faces on TV. Anyway, he pronounced it Sarsha as well. Saoirse is also correct, of course, in whatever dialect applies, and I've also heard it pronounced Saoirse. Anyway, that's what the RFN tagline means. It's a throwback to my days on the run in Ireland when they always signed off even the English language broadcast with something Gaeilge. Okay, there is another email that I found from the same Chris, location unknown. Dear HAC, could you talk about Glenn Miller in one of your shows? I heard you mention him a few times, but find it hard to find out much. Thanks, Chris. Dear Chris, no, I won't. To my extreme distaste, sometimes the goat dancing takes some new twist that, in my opinion, compels some kind of mention on this program, if only to provide my one definitive and official denial. of whatever the bullshit is, the latest one being that I'm allegedly forging the names of 1990s National Alliance people to comments on the Homeland and Thought Crime blogs. No, in point of fact, I'm not. Apparently someone is, true, but it ain't me. And on my list of things in life to worry about, just who is signing the names of people who disappeared 20 years ago is about 1,734th on the list. Oh, by the way, I suppose I should mention that I'm pretty sure that the goat dancer who's using the name of Harlan Markwalder, the old guy that died back in about 10 years ago in Greensboro, I'm pretty sure that's my brother. Anyway, moving right along here, as to Glenn Miller, no, I will only say this again. The time and place is not now, but at some point in the future, white nationalists as a community are going to have to sit down and conduct what they refer to in Alcoholics Anonymous as a fearless and searching moral inventory of ourselves, with a special reference to what happened in the late 1980s and the 1990s. There is a stack of unanswered questions from that entire period that we need to reopen and examine without fear or favor. We need to determine, once and for all, who did what and why and who was signing whose checks. And when that fearless and searching moral inventory does finally take place, Frazier Glenn Miller isn't going to come out of it very well.
Comrades, tonight I would like to talk to you about a book that I read recently called The Far Traveler. This is about a woman who lived during the late Viking Age, and her name is Gundrid or Vaforla, and she's famous because she journeyed to both Greenland and Vinland. Now, the location of Vinland is often debated, but it is very possible that the term Vinland does not really describe one specific place, however, it may just mean North America in general. Although this book does mention an island off Nova Scotia which has many of the necessary characteristics of Vinland. Now, when Gundrid first journeyed to Greenland, she was involved in a shipwreck, and a year after that, her husband Thor died. After that, she married the brother of Leif Erikson. Now, a lot of women in pre-Christian Iceland had more than one marriage, and this could be because of death, but it could also be because of divorce. One of the reasons for this is that women were very scarce in Iceland. First of all, because very few women settled there, and then secondly, because Icelandic society was very male-oriented, and there was a lot of infanticide against baby girls, and so not many women lived to adulthood. And so those that did were often recycled in terms of marriage. Now, this book goes into a lot of technicalities about archaeology. It talks about how archaeologists survey land in order to uncover sites that are buried. And it discussed, to a certain degree, shipbuilding. And also, it discussed how longhouses were made. In Scandinavia, houses were often sod. However, the beams of a house were made with wood and therefore were portable. So oftentimes when Vikings were going on long voyages, and particularly when they meant to settle a new land, they would take beams and rafters with them. Another very important item was cloth, because Vikings wore both linen and wool. And so a very important occupation for women at that time was spinning, so that they could make thread. And at archaeological sites, you will often find spinners, because they were very portable and they were taken to all sorts of locations. This book also talks about how Gundrid encountered American Indians while she was in Vinland, and probably also in Greenland. I would say overall this is a very fascinating book also for sociological reasons, because it talks about the coming of Christianity to Icelandic society, and it discusses how Christianity was often very appealing to women. The author theorizes that this had to do, to some extent, with Nordic mythology, at least that which has come down to us. We have to admit that we don't know everything about Nordic mythology because so much was lost during the conversion. All right, because really, the early Christians were very hostile to paganism. So a lot of the knowledge and the mythology was lost. However, what does come down to us is a sense that Icelandic society was very oriented towards warriors. And if you were not a warrior, then it seems as if there isn't as much of a place for you in the afterlife, even though there are several halls and several options for an afterlife in what comes down to us, which could be rather fragmentary. The other thing is that status was very important in medieval society generally, and really for everyone, but especially for women. If you had a low status, you were really no one, and if you had a high status, then there were certain expectations of you, particularly in marriage. So Christianity would take women away from their status and would give them a sort of new status as a child of God. So it's also theorized that that was a draw. At the end of her life, Gundrid actually ends up becoming a solitary nun, and we're told that she was always Christian. So apparently she was one of the first women, or one of the women that was Christian, but in her case it seems that she was raised Christian. I would say this book was really very informative, even if at times it becomes perhaps overly detailed in terms of archaeology. And I would really suggest a study of the sagas, because I would say that they're an important part of white literature. So I hope you have enjoyed my review, and hopefully I'll come up with some more interesting reviews for you. So have a good evening.
Okay, we were talking about Irish stuff a while ago, so here's Meckham and Clancy.
It was down by the Glenside I met an old woman a-picking young nettles, and she ne'er saw me coming. I listened a while to the song she was humming. Glory, oh, glory, oh, to the Bolfinian men. It's 50 long years since I saw the moon beaming on strong manly forms, and eyes with hope gleaming I'll see them again in all my sad dreaming. Glory, oh, glory, oh, to the Bolfinian men. A young girl, they're marching and drilling. I walk in the Glenside, sounds awesome and thrilling. They loved you. sky they were winning. Glorio, glorio, tore the whole thing in madden. Some died by the landslide, some died with a stranger, and wise men have told us their cause was a failure. They loved dear old Ireland, they never feared danger. Glorio, glorio, tore the bold Fenian men. I went on my way, God be praised that I met her, be life long or short. Sure, I'll never forget her. We may have good men, but we never had better. Glorio, glorio, to the bold Fenian men.
In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who had previously been inserted into Steele's home posing as a handyman in order to spy on the Steele family. While he was working for the Steele family, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of gold and silver that the Steeles were keeping on their property. The final whereabouts of that gold and silver seemed to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance of having to spend 16 months in a minimum security prison in the service of the Bureau. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax, which appeared, even to a layman who first heard them, to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at the key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to swear that the tapes were fraudulent were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by two members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct, and Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life's savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money, and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. It is thought that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained either to Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I have spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. No one knows for sure why the federal government of the United States did this to Edgar Steele. He must have pissed off somebody really bad, although I don't see how. Ed had withdrawn from the Idaho governor's race already due to ill health. I have this horrible suspicion that the whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI, simply to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the regime. Edgar Steele is being held in the Victorville facility in California, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, to the point where the staff and the guards are all issued bottled water to drink, not the inmates. This facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. It's time Edgar Steele's voice was heard once again in the land. if for no other reason than because the FBI and the Obama regime do not want you to hear it. This recording is from 2008, but it's a repeat of a piece that Ed did in 2003, just before Son of Big Iraq attack.
My name is Edgar J. Steele. It's April 17, 2008, and today's piece is entitled, In Defense of Anti-Semitism. Originally, I wanted to call this, Why I Am an Anti-Semite. It's telling indeed that even I finally knuckled under and chose a less sensational title. The silence in America concerning Jews is simply deafening, isn't it? Never unwilling to offend, I would like to talk about Jews today, and not in whispers either. What gets lost in all the saber-rattling and bellicosity concerning Iraq is the why of the impending war. Because the Iraqis hate our freedom? No, obviously not. Because they are too evil to exist? Come on. Because they have used awful weapons, still possess them, and will use them again? Give me a break. On the basis of that rationale, we should be marching on every member of NATO. The Muslims are right, you know. This is a war against Islam, pure and simple. Not Christianity versus Islam. Not the West versus Islam. Not America versus Islam. This is a war between Judaism and Islam. Palestine writ large. Not a religious war either, despite the rhetoric of the Arabs. It is a racial war, and Americans are the cannon fodder. But Israel is our friend, you say. The best friend we have in that hostile quarter of the world. Our only friend, more like it. Israel is our friend so long as we serve its purposes. Indeed, friend is too kind a word. Svengali is more like it. Proof abounds of Israel acting against America's interests at every turn, many of which we will review today. No, Israel does not run America, but the shadowy cartel that does run America is solidly behind Israel. No, not every member of that cartel is Jewish, but so many are that it might as well be exclusive. There was a time in the not-too-distant past when I thought that Jewishness was religious and cultural. Possibly racial, too, but so what? After all, American Jews are generally well-off, well-educated, well-spoken, a little clannish, and well-connected. Just like you and me, only better dressed and with trust funds. Like rich Mormons, maybe. It's an outlook shared by most Americans. It is wrong. This common misperception will prove fatal to America, just as it has to so many nations down through time. This is where I'm supposed to utter the obligatory, I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm really just anti-Zionist. Well, that's a cop-out, and I refuse to do it, even though strictly true. Okay. I'll play. I'm anti-Semitic. So what? Do you really blame me after all that you have done to me, my family, and my country? Nay, the world. Let's get the terms straight. Joe Sabran really is right on the money regarding anti-Semite, first of all, when he says that it used to be defined as being somebody who hates Jews, but now it means a man who is hated by Jews. Ultimately, an anti-Semite is whatever a Jew says, whoever a Jew dislikes, and, ultimately, Jews seem to dislike everybody else. In fact, I've seen Jews acknowledge that everybody who isn't a Jew is, by definition, anti-Semitic. Kind of like the rationale underlying hate crime laws, which are only applied against white people because all white people are deemed racist, per se. Jew. It's a race, not a religion. And I don't want to hear all this buzz about Khazar versus Sephardic Jews or who deserves to claim to be descended from the biblical family of Abraham. There is a group of people scattered throughout the world that calls itself Jewish. We all know who they are, just as do they. They are racially identifiable, even if of two or three flavors. They get the label Jew, and that is reality, history aside. Zionist used to mean those who worked toward the establishment of a Jewish homeland. Now it means Jewish supremacist, pure and simple, kind of like white supremacist, only kosher. Zionism is racism of the first order. Yes, Jews do get persecuted. What gets overlooked is the reason, kind of like focusing on the rights of the murderer and not his victim. No, not kind of. That's exactly what it is. Oi! Foist Egypt,
then Germany. Out here! Why are they persecuting us so?
Trust me, they know precisely why. Generally, it appears to me that someone has to have had a trigger event of some sort happen to themselves or someone close to them before that person is willing to see Jews as predatory. My trigger event actually was two. First, when a lawyer that I hired, hoping that he would work hard and eventually take over my thriving San Francisco law practice, allowing me to retire, tried to steal all my firm's clients, work in progress, and employees, leaving me with nothing. This after only a couple months on the job, too. Jewish, of course. Most lawyers are, you know. Though the sledding was tough with this guy due to the Jewish judges, eventually I eviscerated him financially, and with the help of a black judge at that. Second, and this was the really key event for me, when my children received death threats from a Jewish telephone caller merely because I had dared to represent Richard Butler and the Aryan Nations against a set of false charges. There have been lots of other events since then, but I will never forget the look in my little girl's tear-filled eyes as she told me about the woman who was going to kill her. Watching one's family butchered will make a terrorist of anyone. Just ask the Palestinians. Similarly, watching your family terrorized by Zionists will make you anti-Semitic in a heartbeat. Take it from me. The trigger event serves as a sort of personalized wake-up call. Once awake, the evidence of what is being done to America and the world becomes apparent. None so blind as though who will not see and all that, and that evidence is everywhere. Supposedly Jews account for 2.5% of the American population. Why, then, is half the student body at Harvard and almost every Ivy League college Jewish? Statistics simply are not kept as to the percentage of Jews in this profession or that, but when was the last time you saw a doctor whose name did not end in Berg, Mann, or Stein? I'm not sure I've ever met a psychiatrist who wasn't Jewish. On the other hand, have you ever seen a Jewish farmer or mechanic? Rarely do I appear in court, but what the guy on the other side of the courtroom, and often as not the judge too, is Jewish. And it's incredible the deference paid by the bench to the Jewish DA or whoever sitting at the other counsel table. There has been more than one trial where I could have merely phoned in my participation for all the good that it mattered that I was even there. So many complain about what bankers, especially the international and central bankers, are doing to our country. Yet hardly anybody seems to have noticed that those people are almost exclusively Jewish. They are everywhere in the media, particularly Hollywood. Talking heads, movie stars, and the like. Curly hair, hook nose, and names that rhyme. Pay attention, you'll be amazed. The names won't always be a good guideline, however, given how many changed their names at the turn of last century, so as to meld into the American population of that time. Jews seem to comprise about 50% of America's population based upon those in visible positions. Looks can be deceiving, though, because like Harvard, they are drawn to those positions by their money, their intelligence, and most importantly, the indulgence of their kosher comrades. People refuse to notice the Jewish hands on virtually every power lever in the U.S. federal government, or at the helm of virtually every media organization that exists, and throughout the executive and editorial ranks. The problem is, most of Americans seem not to know it. Books have been written on the subject, but essentially a group of late 19th century elites, comprised of Rockefeller, Morgan, and others, mostly Jewish, established an organization designed to consolidate their control of America, and eventually the entire world. It was called the Council on Foreign Relations, or the CFR. Offshoots, such as the Bilderbergers, have formed since then, but the objective has never slipped from their sight. One of the first acts of CFR's members was to survey the newspaper field, the sole mass media of the time, and conclude that purchasing control of only 25 major newspapers would give them effective control of news dissemination. They went out and bought those papers, and since then, many, many more. Today, members of these shadowy organizations literally run virtually all of the media, control the political structure in America, much of world business, and are firmly in control of world banking. That is why the two political parties in America have become identical, so as to provide us rubes with the illusion of throwing the rascals out come election time, yet with the same old agenda, not missing a beat. Did you really see a difference from Bush to Clinton to Bush? They knew what NAFTA would do to America's manufacturing base and job structure, yet both parties embraced it. We're firmly on a path to one world government, America writ large. But the America now being molded without individual civil rights, not the America of the 20th century, and it's largely kosher. It is not the purpose of today's essay to prove Jewish control of America. There is ample material available on the internet for those who wish to prove it for themselves. Rather, it is my purpose to show that there are perfectly valid and understandable, even laudable, reasons for being anti-Semitic. Resenting those who manipulate us on a daily basis, against our own best interests, is primary among them. 2.5% Jews versus 70% Caucasian, used to be 95% not too long ago, yet they set the agenda domestically and internationally. Why else do you think we are even in the Middle East? The oil is the excuse that allows us cynically to stop and look no deeper. Notice the extreme difference between U.S. policy in the Middle East versus elsewhere, exemplified by the fact that we are invading and destroying Iraq, a country with nothing, while we give a pass to North Korea, a country which just threatened to nuke America. And it's not enough that Zionists control America. They have to reshape it to suit themselves. Virtually every recent case that involves the removal of Christian symbols from society is brought and or prosecuted by a Jew, usually with a Jewish judge presiding. For the sake of the feelings of 2.5%, all the rest of us must yield our cultural heritage, removing Under God from the Pledge of Allegiance, taking down plaques of the Ten Commandments, removing crosses from public venues, erecting menorahs in public venues, taking Christ out of Christmas first, then Christmas out of the year-end holidays altogether. Hate laws are a singularly Jewish invention being foisted upon an unsuspecting public so as to preemptively remove the possibility of criticism of themselves, often written by the ADL, the organization that lobbies for their adoption state by state. The laws are designed to stifle dissent and speaking out. Even now, the ADL seeks to broaden their sweep to include Holocaust revisionism, as has occurred in Canada and most of Europe, where many people sit in jail for publicly stating true fact about the so-called Holocaust that Jews simply do not want publicized. America's borders are kept wide open to a flood of illegal immigrants purposely, apparently to dilute the population. Why else? Thereby making us much more easily controlled. Yet there is a furious struggle to expel those who criticize Jews, such as is taking place with Ernst Zundel. Contrast this policy imposed upon America with the extremely closed society of Israel, which is reserved solely for Jews. The money that Israel has cost America, facilitated by their Jewish brethren, is nothing short of breathtaking. Policy in the Middle East has been very costly to the U.S., as well as to the rest of the world. The cost to the U.S. of its policies in the region has accumulated to over $2.5 trillion, an amount greater than the cost of the Vietnam War. About two-thirds of those costs, in the area of $1.6 trillion, arose from the U.S. defense of Israel since 1973. Since 1973, however, protection of Israel and subsidies to countries such as Egypt and Jordan, willing to sign peace treaties with Israel, has been the prime driver of U.S. outlays, or the trigger for crisis costs. $2.5 trillion. Boggles the mind, doesn't it? Let's see now. America has a population of 290 million and about 80 million households, so that amounts to $31,250 from your family to Israel. And that doesn't include some other items, which could easily double that figure. Rescue of Israel in 1973 by President Nixon cost the U.S. almost $900 billion in lost GDP, resulting from the Arab oil embargo and higher oil import costs. Worsening political relations resulted in the loss of hundreds of thousands of U.S. jobs. Hundreds of billions additionally were spent on Project Independence, ostensibly to emancipate the U.S. from reliance upon Middle Eastern oil. The projects were largely co-opted by domestic lobbies of diverse colorations, and little imported oil was actually displaced. What's ironic, if not pathetic, is that an incredible amount of our own tax dollars given to Israel come back in the form of campaign contributions to American politicians. funneled through American Jewish hands and foundations, making Israeli and Jewish interests the single largest lobby in Washington, D.C. Any politician who dares to vote or speak against Zionist interests faces a withering campaign at election time, ultimately funded by this country's own taxpayers in the main. Now you see why Sharon's statement about controlling the U.S. is true, quite aside from the considerable direct control exercised by American Jews. Zionists will do anything to advance their own interests. The 1967 extended attempt to sink the USS Liberty in international waters off the coast of Gaza, for example, killing 37 U.S. sailors and injuring another 174. Now, it's unclear whether the Israelis were attempting to eliminate witnesses to atrocities they were committing during the Six Days War, or attempting to create their own event by blaming Egypt for sinking the Liberty with all hands. False flag operations are particularly favorite Israeli ploys, however, so as to curry support. There are far too many problems with the official 9/11 story, too. The only real question that remains is whether the U.S. or Israel was really behind it. Few people are raising questions about the obviously false statements we have been told about 9/11. Why did it take 28 minutes for flight controllers to notify NORAD two planes had been hijacked when the average time to do so in such a case is 3 minutes? Why were fighters scrambled from a base 180 miles away when seven other bases had fighter jets ready that could have done the job in a fraction of the time? Why was FEMA in New York the night before the crashes? Why did those fires at the base of the towers burn for 100 days? Why did Bush read a book for a half hour when he knew two planes had hit and two more were hijacked? Why was the Bin Laden family flown out of the country when all flights were grounded? Why did the FBI chief say we had no warning this was coming, and everybody else in the FBI say we had plenty of warning? Who did make the billions of dollars from all those put options on two airlines the day before the attack? These are only a fraction of the questions the government continues to cover up, as several billions of people know. Not a mention of the Israeli art students caught celebrating on a rooftop nearby while they photographed the ghastly spectacle. Nor of all the missing Israeli executives and workers that day, people who otherwise would have died in the World Trade Center. Nor of the 2-hour advance warning provided to the employees at Odigo in the building. Odigo is a Jewish telephone firm. Nor of many other indicators of Israeli involvement. In particular, hardly anybody wants to discuss who benefited from 9/11. The Afghanis? Yeah, right. Al-Qaeda? Not a chance. Iraq? Sure. What country was plummeting in the world's opinion, especially America's, at the time? What country whose fortunes in that regard turned around 180 degrees overnight? Israel, of course. And we haven't even discussed what Israel has done to the hapless Palestinians or what they're about to do, just as soon as we're distracted by Baghdad 2. As if the provisions of Patriot Acts 1 and 2, whereby Americans can be jailed without hearings, stripped of their citizenship, and deported for further processing, aren't enough. Recently, Israeli hit squads were given the go-ahead to roam the entire world, including America, all the better to protect Israel's interests. Yes, there are an abundance of reasons to be offended by Israelis, Zionists, and even the Jews who provide cover for their brethren. Most people deny the existence of most of those reasons and ignore the rest, until they suffer their own trigger event, that is. Every time I talk about Zionists, or Jews, or Israel, I come under an incredible insult on my website and my email servers, some from Lebanon, where Israel maintains internet servers, and even more from American Jews. False claims to my ISPs in an attempt to get me shut up. And viruses, well, you wouldn't believe how many. And hate speech. You haven't even seen hate speech until you've seen what righteously indignant Jews can deliver. If you could just see what will be happening on my computer in the coming week, that alone likely would make you a believer. But it's important that these things be said. Out loud, too, not in whispers. People have to wake up. It's almost too late. You see, they're on the verge of adapting the hate crime laws to outlaw such discussions altogether. Finally, I simply cannot let you go without adding my own little twist on the age-old Jewish wail about anti-Semitism being a disease. Yes, I agree that anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. New America, an idea whose time has come.
This is the Pine Creek String Band. Time for another reading from my Weird Aryan History series, which, for those of you who came in late, is a series of 56 articles I did on various weird and wonderful aspects of our people's past, and I sent them out by email. Still do occasionally. In fact, tell you what, let me actually read you the introduction to that series. Please bear in mind that this was written originally about 2005 or so, and so it's a little dated. Someone once said that Americans are people without a past. I once saw a statistic to the effect that less than 50% of Americans, meaning white Americans, can name all four of their grandparents. I mean actually name them. Grandpa and Meemaw don't count. And less than 10% could name more than one great-grandparent. Many Americans confuse the Korean War with World War II, Something like 30% of the reporters in the Gulf War did not know that there had been a World War I, although you'd think the designation of World War II might have tipped them off that there was a previous version floating around somewhere. That's a true story. We as a people have no idea of where we've been, so it's no wonder that we have no idea where we're going. Now, my Weird Aryan History series is an attempt to remedy that, to inform white nationalists of some of the more interesting events in the history of our people, and let them know that yes, in fact, there were Aryan events going on before the time of cowboys and Indians, which is as far back as most Americans have any historical awareness at all. Beyond a highly inaccurate movie version of the Wild West, some Americans have a vague impression of the Civil War. Some reenactors are downright anal about the 1861-1865 period to the exclusion of the other 3,000-odd years of Western civilization, just like some National Socialists can recite a day-by-day history of the Third Reich from 1933 to 1945 and nothing else at all. But there's a dimmer impression in a few American consciousnesses of George Washington crossing the Delaware and guys in white wigs signing something in 1776. And beyond that, there's Elmer Fudd in Puritan dress, wearing a cartoon steeple crown hat and carrying a blunderbuss, hunting turkeys for Thanksgiving. Nobody in the 17th or 18th centuries hunted with a blunderbuss, by the way. Anyway, Elmer has his little run-ins with Bugs Bunny. I'm sure you've seen all these things. Now, for 99% of Americans, that's it. Now, in addition to being a people with amnesia, we're also a very sleazy people, as the current preoccupation with court TV and assorted media-hyped crap indicates, from Scott Peterson to Natalie Holloway. Fine, I'm sleazy too, so I'll be selecting all kinds of weird, wonderful, violent, bloody, bizarre, and ghastly stuff from the history of our race and presenting it for our own little tabloid show right here on the internet. I started off last night with The Mystery of the Princes and the Tower in 1483. Now, these articles will, in fact, be mostly fairly long and detailed, and you'll have to dust off the old attention span and give it a good workout to read and understand most of them. But I'll try to intersperse short little Aryan factoids as well. I think this will actually be a kind of an entertaining project, something to occupy myself while waiting for the lights to go out, and something many of you will appreciate. If you don't, there's always the old delete button. Okay, are we clear on what the Weird Aryan History series is and why? We do know that there is a purpose to it, and it's not just Harold losing his marbles. Good. Anyway, that was the introduction. Now, when I'd done the first 10 or so of these articles, somebody complained to me that there were no Vikings in it. A lot of our new and lesser developed comrades seem to think that our pre-American history consisted of nothing but Vikings, which isn't true. As impressive as that part of our past is, the Viking era was just one short period of about 300 years, and only a small part of the whole magnificent tapestry of the Aryan past. But anyway, to satisfy Viking fans, I came up with this piece about the Battle of Maldon in England in 991 AD. England at the end of the 10th century was ruled by King Ethelred II, who's commonly described as Ethelred the Unready. That doesn't mean unprepared, it actually means no counsel or ill-advised in Old English, which he was, apparently. This guy seems to have been a 10th century Homer Simpson. His reign was punctuated by ever-increasing raids upon his territory by the ravaging and pillaging Vikings in their dragon ships. Ethelred had no military or diplomatic answer to their raids, and so he simply raised a series of taxes called Danegeld to pay them off. And from this arose the saying that once you pay the Danegeld, you'll never get rid of the Dane. I know that none of you understand that, but yes, there was a time in living memory when white people used to know and remember these little sayings from our past, before we devoted our lives to staring into electronic screens. Anyway, the earliest Norse raiders of this period descended on England in small companies, which came ashore without warning and departed before meeting anything but local resistance. And in the 980s, they circumnavigated the entire British Isles in their search for plunder, visiting, among other places, Hampshire, Kent, and Cheshire, Devon, Cornwall, Dorset. No part of the coast was safe, and Essex and the Blackwater estuary towns like Maldon were no exception. Now, in August of 991, 1,021 years ago, yet another body of raiders appeared off the English coast with Olaf Tryggvason at their head. It was larger than any of the other forces that had been lately raiding the coast, probably greater than 3,000 men, and to some extent it was much more an organized army than a raiding party. Its ravages are important in English financial history because they compel the government to raise a particularly heavy Danegeld tax in order to buy off the invaders. But the War of 991 would be no more than a dim episode in a monotonous succession of disasters if it weren't for a great poem which describes the death of Byrhtnoth, the alderman, or king's representative of Essex, who was killed in a battle against the Norse. In the second week in August, after looting Ipswich, which is 40 miles to the northeast, the Northmen entered the Blackwater estuary and occupied Northey Island, which is to the east of Maldon, which in Old English, by the way, means hill with a cross, so this was probably some kind of landmark. For access to the mainland, they depended then, as today, on a single causeway, which was flooded at high tide, and which led from Northey to the flats along the southern bank of the river. Now, before the Vikings left their camp on the island, Byrhtnoth, with his retainers and a hastily assembled force of local militia, had taken possession of the landward end of the causeway. The Vikings yelled across the water while the tide was high, and they were demanding gold and silver tribute in exchange for their leaving. Now, you have to remember that in those days, Old English and Norse, which languages were descended from a common ancestor we'll be hearing in a bit, were still sufficiently close so that Englishmen and Scandinavians could understand one another. However, Byrhtnoth refused, and he drew up his men along the bank, and he waited, as did the Vikings, for the tide to go out. As the water fell, the Vikings began to stream out along the causeway, but three of Byrhtnoth's retainers, who must have been some real Conan-type badasses, held the crossing against them, and at last the Vikings asked to be allowed to cross unhindered and fight on equal terms on the mainland. Now, even at low tide, the causeway is no more than a few feet wide at best, and both to the left and right is the sticky black ooze of the Essex salt marshes. A man weighed down with weapons and armor and thick mud would be no match for those waiting on dry land. It was a virtually unassailable position, and yet, as a matter of personal honor or vanity or pride or else just plain arrogant overconfidence because he wanted to look good for the bardic poets, Byrhtnoth agreed to their request, and so the Vikings rushed over the river through the falling tide, and a major battle started on the south shore. It was a fearsome fight with no quarter asked or given on either side. The English were well aware of the ferocity of the Vikings, who in their turn knew that there could be no surrender this far from home. The issue was decided when Byrhtnoth himself was killed. Many of his men immediately threw down their weapons and ran, and the English ranks were broken. But what gives enduring interest to the battle is the superb courage with which a group of Byrhtnoth's thanes, that is, his personal military guard, knowing that the fight was lost, nonetheless, deliberately fought to the death in order that they might avenge their fallen lord. A plaque has been erected on the spot to mark the site, and I suppose it'll remain there until some Jamaican gang drives up from London and drags it off for a marijuana and booze party on the beach or whatever. The Battle of Maldon is one of the great epic bardic poems of the old Anglo-Saxon language. It celebrates courage and resignation and dignity in the face of death and all the various virtues that our ancestors held so dear. Unfortunately, only a fragment of it has survived. Now, the author is unknown. I won't attempt to read it to you now, nor was I able to locate any recording of it I could play for you. And so what we're going to have to do here to give you some kind of idea of the flavor or the spirit of what I'm talking about is we're going to have to make do with the prologue from Beowulf, which is the oldest surviving work of literature anywhere in the English language. Now, Beowulf is believed to have been composed in the 8th century AD, the author being an unknown bard or troubadour living in what is now coastal Germany. Just to give you some idea of how fragile our far past is and how much of it we've lost, for over 1,000 years, this poem survived in one written copy, what is known as the Noel or Noel Codex, which knocked around in assorted libraries and private collections for centuries. Nobody even knew what it was. It was forgotten for lifetimes. Only the grace of God prevented it from being lost forever. In 1731, it was almost destroyed in a fire. The book containing the poem survived, but the pages were badly scorched, as can be seen to this day in the original manuscript. Now, finally, in 1815, through some accident, a Danish and Icelandic scholar named Grimur Johansson Thorkellen stumbled across the poem in some dusty English library. He realized what he was looking at, and he published the first printed version in that year, thus making sure that this epic saga from many centuries ago would survive. You have to wonder how much else from our far past has disappeared forever down through the centuries out of stupidity or carelessness. Anyway, these are the opening lines of Beowulf, spoken in the best reconstruction that scholars can make of Old English. With the possible exception of Irish, which is still actually spoken by a small number of people, this is probably the most pure form of a true ancient Aryan tongue that survives today.
Wet we gardena in yardagum, thou'd cunning a thrung a frunan, who's the etherling a sell and fremedon. Oft shield shaving, jether a threadum, monigum make them, made yourself a oft. Ay, so the erlast, Susan erst where fersh a funden. Hey, that's frofery, but wales in the wolknum earth minum tha. Os at him elch wyrs dar a sit tendra of a chrunra de hŵr an siwr y gomban iolan that was good cunning. Tham efer a wes saf di gen y dong yn iard an thani gog synd ffwg ydw ffrofr ffyr an saf o'n iar tat i adrw gan alo leas y lang y chwyl. Him thus leafria, woldus weld and wool out of foria, Beowulf west bramer, that weed is sprung, shield is ephra, shillandum in. Swas your young guma, gold gewirchen, from umvel giftum and ferre berme, that hina on ul de eft gewunigen, will je see this. On the weak goom a loud gelast and loft out um shell and maist a gehwere mang gethel. Hint a shult goar to gerst of wheeler fell a chrofeir an unfrail an wear. He hunes a earthran to bremus farther swears a gesidas. Swa he self a bad tenden world um weld ween a shulding a leaf land from a lange achter. The art who the stored hring and stiffna is he gone out fools etheling is fair.
These are the men we once were. These are the men that we can become again, if we can but change our thinking and recover our ancient courage. All right, I'm already running long, so I need to wind this up fairly quickly. There's something I want to address now, and I'll try to make it short and sweet, or maybe not so sweet. Guys, I really, really am trying to choose my words carefully and diplomatically here. I really, really don't want to appear rude and arrogant and dismissive of the very people who keep me alive and functioning. I can't do that. I don't dare do that. But you guys still aren't getting the message, and somehow I have to make you get the message. Now, I am still being dragged helter-skelter against my will into dealing with people-related bullshit, because there is no one else. Now, I freely admit the fact that there is no one else is my fault, as I stated several weeks ago. My standards are just too high, and while I won't go so far as to say that the people who can do this job, the white people in the right age range who still carry the old alpha gene, don't exist, they do. They're out there somewhere. I have to concede that the chance that we will be able to locate them, identify them, motivate them, and get them here to the homeland and activate them in time to make any practical difference in our immediate situation is non-existent. I'm not going to go into Grandpa Simpson mode here, because joking aside, I understand that nobody really wants to listen to Grandpa moan and whine and complain. But to make a long story short, the message I'm getting is that I have to quit fucking around and finish this last Northwest novel. Now, what this means is that for roughly 3 days a week, I'm going to have to live in another world. The world of the future that we're going to create when we decide we want it bad enough. Yes, that's one of the few good things about being me. I get to actually see the prize. You just get to read about it. Now, for at least 2 full days of the week, I have to be working on this podcast. Now, with writing time, that leaves me 2 days remaining out of the week to do everything else. I can't do it and still have to mess with all the dysfunctional, crazy people and movement crap, and I'm running out of time. My self-imposed deadline for the completion of Freedom's Sons is Thanksgiving, but I may have to extend that to Christmas because this really is the last hurrah for the NVA in fiction, and I intend to go out on a high note and not do sloppy work because I'm rushed by some self-appointed deadline and I have subsequently had days and days of my time wasted in dealing with people stuff. Now, the fact is, guys, that from now on and for the foreseeable future, you're pretty much on your own. I can't deal with the people stuff right now. God, I know that sounds horrible, but I just don't know how else to say it. Now, given that after completion of Freedom's Sons, the next task will be publication of the complete novel in one book and another special project I'll speak of in the organizational letter, I will not even be able to attempt any organizing people stuff for, frankly, at least a year, until I get all my decks cleared. Now, assuming that I'm still on my feet and not medically or legally disabled, this will put me close to 2014 and the time when I will violate federal law by not purchasing health insurance under Obamacare, and I really will be a criminal. And the FBI can legitimately come and arrest me and charge me with a crime, because at age 60, for the first time in my life, I'll actually be guilty of one. And no, Romney isn't going to win, because normal people are now outnumbered in the 7 or 8 states with the electoral votes to make him president. And secondly, even if the Republicans did win, they won't win the Senate. And even if they win both, the Republicans won't have the balls to repeal Obamacare. So in 2014, I'm going to be a criminal, along with millions of other Americans, and the FBI can finally do their thing. Until then, I have a checklist of things I have to accomplish, and there's virtually no time allocated for dealing with people problems. I was going to talk about one specific example this week, but no, I decided not to do that. That's because the guy in question is not a bad person. Jesus, I know I say that a lot, but really, come right down to it, we have very few actual bad people in the movement. I've been in 40 years, and there are only about 6 individuals I have met in that time who I consider to be genuinely bad or dangerous to the cause. We just get a lot of confused and dysfunctional white people who have never been taught to think and not to feel. In other words, we get 21st century Americans. The great British National Socialist Colin Jordan put it best when he wrote, "Our movement has a very big heart and a very small head." That has to change. I'm trying to change it now, and that means I'm going to have to start just pulling the plug completely on personal interaction for about 5 days a week. Sorry, guys, but it is what it is. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. Now, this is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Still is beating heart and hope's boarding.